Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Politics Jam, where we take an in-depth look at the week's news and hot topics through a political science lens with myself and Mike. Mike, as always. Mike, how are you doing today, buddy?
I am fantastic, thank you, Jeeve. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well today, Michael. It's a lovely day. Back inside my flat again, which is great. So it's going well. Today, on the pod, we're going to be discussing Black Lives Matter, race relations in the UK and the US, as well as Black history. And we've got a very special guest with us today. So as I'm sure you're already aware, Michael is a rising star in race relations research within the United Kingdom. And with us as our guest is Gary Young, who I'm sure most of you are already well aware was an award-winning author, broadcaster, and a professor of sociology at the University of Manchester. The author of 5 books, and most recently, Another Day in the Death of America, a moving portrait of 10 children killed by gun crime on the 23rd of November, 2013, within the United States. Gary, how are you doing today, mate?
I'm well, thank you. Yeah.
It's good to hear. Now, Gary, I'm a Newtonian, so I know that you grew up down the road from me in Stevenage, along with Lewis Hamilton. What is it about Stevenage's proximity to Luton that makes it produce such successful sons?
You know, it's a very interesting question there, because the most prominent people to come from Stevenage, it's got a very small black population. And those prominent people to come from Stevenage, Lewis Hamilton, Ashley Young, Giles Torreira, who won the Perrier Award. It's had 2 black mayors and a black chief of police. And I haven't quite got to the bottom of it yet, I must say. Roland Butcher, the first black player to play for England, he was from Stevenage, went to the same school as my auntie. And but I think it may have something to do with the fact that Stevenage was a new town. And so to that extent, while a lot of people who moved to Stevenage actually moved to get away from black people, actually, the truth be told, but that the institutions in Stevenage hadn't been around long enough for racism to really embed itself. Everybody was an immigrant of sorts. And there wasn't long enough for it to be like, well, this is the way we do things. And because it was a new town set up in kind of 1948 with the, you know, same year as the NHS, with this sort of wonderful notion, Lewis Silkin, the town planning minister, he said, people will come from all over the world to see what we do in Stevenage, which they did not. But it was about creating a new person. I mean, they actually said that it's a new social democratic person. And so when I was growing up there in the 70s, there was a lot of racism, but there were no no-go areas. There were no schools that were ultimately completely failed. There was lots of places for racism to exist, but nowhere that it had been there long enough for it to bed down. And I wonder whether that's got something to do with it. That's the best I've come up with, anyway. And it does intrigue me, not least because, and you'll appreciate this as a Lutonian, I went to Luton to do some reporting about 2010, and people in someone in Luton asked me, you know, where I was from, and I said Stevenage. And they sort of sucked their teeth out. Oh, Stevenage, like Stevenage is rough. And I thought, if people from Luton are saying Stevenage is rough, it must be rough. Because that's what we used to say about Luton.
That is my perception too. Stevenage was, actually, I don't think Stevenage was rough. Stevenage was seen as being more deprived. You're like, Stevenage, you're like, oh, okay. And then conversations moved on, basically.
Yeah, like Luton would be sending Stevenage food parcels or something. It was, I was intrigued, because when, I don't know that I would have thought that. I'm just going by sight, but I'm considerably older than you, I think. I'm 51. And when I grew up there, that certainly wouldn't have been the case. Not that Stevenage would have been seen as a, you know, shining city on a hill or something, but it wasn't seen as kind of sort of, it wouldn't have got that response in Luton anyway.
What indeed. And so let's move on to where we are sitting and why we are all here today. So in terms of Black Lives Matter, we've seen that this summer's protests are the power of they've had. We saw the largest and widest protests in American history across the country, from small white towns to large diverse cities after the death of George Floyd. But while there was widespread support for the movement, that has declined recently. So 67% supported Black Lives Matter in June, down to 55% today. And that's largely due to support in the non-Black communities. We know that defund the police is a very unpopular slogan, so only a quarter of the US public support reducing, let alone defunding the police. And there is some evidence that the protests were viewed to be violent by some people. I suppose my question for the both of you really is what are your reflections on the movement over the summer, and why do you think that the Black Lives Matter has got to here and where it should go from here?
I mean, my view is that it was always going to come down somewhat. And what has interested me about Black Lives Matter is how it's pollinated. So it emerged in America and then it just kind of it pollinated and its seeds landed, you know, in Belgium around King Leopold statues, and in Holland around Vater Piet, and in Britain around Colston and, you know, curricula and a range of things. And that kind of, I mean, this stuff is difficult to track, but certainly anecdotally, I feel like it emboldened a range of people, and that those consequences are still going on. I say beneath the radar, and I kind of mean beneath my radar in a way, like, because I'm not reporting anymore, but that in all sorts of different ways, I hear stories of people in different institutions or unions or their community kind of challenging things that they maybe wouldn't have challenged before, or just speaking up when they wouldn't have spoke up before, or getting together when they wouldn't have gotten together before. And so we certainly haven't seen, I think, the last of it. And I also think that the defund the police, I feel like it's an unfortunate slogan, because another way of talking about defund the police would be to talk about public health approach to crime, basically. That, you know, when I was at The Guardian, I did a lot of work on knife crime. And even the police would say, look, we can't do this. We can't do all this. These kids are being off-road and excluded at a rate that we can't keep up with, so they're out all day. There's no youth clubs. The police were saying, we are, CAMHS, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, are kind of under a massive amount of pressure. And actually, a lot of the stuff isn't police work. We're just kind of, you know, we are, I mean, they are, to quote Stuart Hall, they're police in a crisis, the crisis of austerity. And so, and as I understand defund the police, that's what he's saying, is actually there's an awful lot of work that the police are doing that they shouldn't be doing. But when people hear defund the police, they hear abolish the police or just take away their money. And so defund the police doesn't teach anyone where that money would go. Do you know what I mean? And so that it's, I don't love it as a slogan, to be honest. As an idea, I don't only think it's right. I think there would be kind of an awful lot of support for it. And the idea that the Tories, who have literally been defunding the police, should be opposed. It's like, you started it, man. You've been defunding the police for the last 10 years. I don't know what they're complaining about. So it's a little bit semiotic and meme-like, but I kind of wish that they would come up with a different slogan. It's certainly, in America at least, there have been groups that have been working on it for a long time and all the rest of with that slogan. In Britain, there wasn't. So I really don't think it translates. But I also think that it actually undersells what it's doing, because it's about defunding. It's not about – it doesn't suggest, and people don't often look under the bonnet, a redistribution.
I agree with that, Gary. I guess with defund the police, it's something that would exist on a spectrum, right? So there's some people who say defund the police and they mean complete and utter abolition of the police, right? And I think there are some people who sit on the other end. And I think the way it's used in the UK certainly is, let's relocate funds. Let's move away from this narrow conception of justice, where the police are the arbiters, the sole arbiters of justice. So the police are the ones who resolve every single crisis we have. So when someone has a mental health panic attack, for example, or mental health crisis in the middle of the street, the police probably aren't the best people to respond to that crisis. It should be someone else responding to that. And we're asking the police to do things they aren't trained to do, essentially. And I think that's the message we defund the police in the UK is the idea of, let's move away from this narrow conception of justice. I also do think it's an unfortunate slogan. It's not one that cuts through well to the general public. There has been talk about whether it's cost the Democrats some votes in certain parts of America, in terms of Democrats losing some seats. I'm not entirely sure about that. I'm skeptical about those claims, but it is an unfortunate slogan. I think it's something that it's more of an like something that's been well developed in America, as you mentioned, Gary. So I don't think the scholarship's been as well developed in the UK in terms of how defund the police would work practically in the UK. So I know that Adam Elliott Cooper is an academic at Greenwich University. I spoke to him about it, and he's someone's been working on defund the police in a British context. But I know that certainly what I think frames the Black Lives Matter movements in certain parts of America is a move away from police reform and actually move to police abolition. But these groups have been working on this for a long, long time, as opposed to in the UK. I still think there has been some work on this, but it's much, this work is in its infancy, I think, compared to what's happened in America.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm sure there's academic work been done. I just kind of I think he in America there had been considerable grassroots political work, even in Minneapolis, that you know they could feed off. But I also that notion. The notion of the defund the police cost them the election. I mean, I'm glad you're skeptical. I think that is bollocks. I mean, for a couple of reasons. And the first is that look at where we had to wait for votes in order for Biden to win. Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Detroit. Those were the places where, for Biden to win, the big vote had to come in. It was black people, not for the last time, as it was black people who actually got Biden the nomination. But this came afterwards. And I'm sure defund the police wasn't unpopular in Philadelphia, where there were riots actually just before the election. I mean, I'm sure there are... all sorts of black people who are kind of nervous about where this moment goes and all of that. But the notion that it cost them the election, it's like, from whom? But secondly, it was during the rebellions, there was a massive spike in African-American registration, that those rebellions kind of encouraged people to go vote and to kind of, you know, bloody hell, to go and vote for Biden, who wouldn't be the obvious choice if you wanted a radical transformation of society. But in order to stop Trump and the bigotry, that's what people did. And so, I mean, it's a peculiar thing to me in this moment that black people both delivered Biden the nomination and delivered him the presidency and are being blamed somehow for kind of creating a narrative that freaked white people out. Well, white people, a significant section, they were already freaked out. And it had nothing to do with the existence of black people was freaking them out, you know. And the notion as well that we should just carry on getting shot in the street and not do anything about it so that Biden can get elected is a little bit daft, right? I mean, those demonstrations took place independently, completely autonomously of the Democratic Party. They didn't exist in order to get someone elected or not. They existed to preserve black life. And Biden's response, one of his responses was, well, maybe the police should shoot people in the leg. Like, we don't want to be shot in the leg. You know, we'd rather just walk around, and if we commit crimes, then arrest us for the crimes. It's not like, well, we should be grateful because we keep, you know, we're all hopping around. We've all been shot in the leg while we're walking around being innocent rather than being shot in the head or being strangled or throttled or whatever. So it's as though whatever happens, we were to blame, and whatever we did doesn't count, which is, just seems kind of it seems like a really weird place for people to go. And I saw that Nick Timothy, Theresa May's chief advisor, he kicked off about that, and I thought, man, you were responsible for deporting British citizens. Why should we be listening to you about anything? So I'm not only skeptical, I'm actually contemptuous of the idea that, not that it, that that slogan might not have put people off, but if anyone, you know, first of all, that moment actually encouraged a large number of people to vote. And secondly, if you can be put off voting against Donald Trump by a slogan, then it was never going to take that much, was it?
Can I ask more of a meta question, actually, which is that we talk about Black Lives Matter. We spoke about it at the June at the time of being a moment and a large moment. But you two seeing this, the current being longer, is it more of a case of, rather than it being a turning point, it being a change in a trend? So like, rather than it being this like, okay, oh wow, there's this awakening and now things are going to change. Because it feels like the civil, it feels like if I was there during the civil rights marches and I was there to watch Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream, the Civil Rights Act, I would have been like, wow, this is a real turning point in relations. And actually maybe it was more of a trend towards a better world going forward. I know we're not so far out of it, but how do you guys see, kind of, when people look back on this Black Lives Matter moment, will they say, hey, here was a real turning point for race relations, or will it be, actually, here was like almost a kink and here's like a slightly different direction?
I think it's part of the trend even. So what was quite heartening about the protest for me over the summer was that we saw, these were generational protests, right? We saw young people take to the streets in their numbers and protest against racial injustice. Mm. That was what was quite striking for me. I guess over the summer, we saw a willingness for the news to kind of embrace conversations about racial justice, right? So we saw people being invited on television to discuss race. We saw all kinds of television shows on race and racism. And these things tend to happen, right? It's a news cycle. These things tend to peak and trough, right? The problem is these things don't stay in the news cycle for that long. And race has often been like this, where, you know, an incident happens, for example, like knife crime happens and people are talking about the police and the Black communities and Black Lives Matter and all these sort of things. And it naturally fades into oblivion. I think that the key for me and what needs to emerge from these summer protests is a sustained focus on change. There needs to be sustained pressure on the government to enact the change required. I'm skeptical a Conservative government can enact the change required, because I think Conservative governments are quite apathetic to social justice, and that's the problem. But certainly this can't be a summer you look back on as just like, this thing happened, there were loads of protests and we move on. This needs to be part of a move for sustained change in the UK and across Europe, because these protests were framed as like, what was annoying me for me was, I think Matt Hancock made a remark of like, the protests were a response to what happened in America and George Floyd's murder. And yes, they were a direct response to that. And it was a display of solidarity across Europe and across the world for African Americans. But also protests across Europe, across the world, also try to raise awareness on issues happening in those countries. So there's real problems of racism in this country. And that's what the protests in this country were aiming to highlight. Same with the protests in Belgium, the protests in France that we saw. So there are real problems in other countries that need to be addressed. And I think there is a real desire among young people, younger generation in particular, for their voices to be heard on racial justice. I think one thing that I've really thought about over the last few days and a few weeks is racism is a matter of life and death. And that's something that really decided this election for me. Like Gary mentioned how decisive Black voters were in Joe Biden's victory. And they really were. And for Black voters, this election was a matter of life and death. You know, they're disproportionately affected by COVID-19. And also, Donald Trump's approach to racial injustice threatened their lives. He had no desire to tackle racial injustice in America. And that was a threat to the lives of America, of Black Americans. So they acted in a way and they voted for Joe Biden because they think and they hope that he's someone that's going to have their best interests at heart. Whether that happens remains to be seen. But yeah, I just think the summer protests needs to be part of a push for sustained change.
Yeah, I would just add to that I think what's particular about this moment, and it's as true in America as well, although America has other things going for it, is that Black Lives Matter is like a floating signifier, really, that attaches itself to the people who are protesting racism. It's not like if you go to Chicago, there's a Black Lives Matter office, or if you go to, that's one of the key differences between the 60s and now. There was, in the 60s, there was a movement with structures and decision-making and press releases and all of the things that go with a kind of, with a movement, you know, actual bricks and mortar buildings and executives and all that kind of stuff. Whereas this is much more kind of inchoate and makeshift, and so it can burn really brightly and then fade. And just as an example, so I live in Hackney in London, and there was a demonstration not far from where I live, where I've never seen a demonstration before, and I would say there were a few thousand people there, and I think I found out about it on Facebook. I can't really remember. My wife told me. We went up. We met some friends. It was in the middle of COVID, so it was first time we'd met people. People took a knee. They raised a fist. I don't know who organized it. Nobody took any names. So there'd be no way of reconvening that group of people. And yet, thanks to sort of social media, which can caffeinate things, you have this kind of... this moment of congress and then this moment of dissipation, and which raises the question of how we sustain, you know, the demands, all these institutions. I'm sure the one that you're at, certainly University of Manchester, they made very bold statements. How do you hold them to that? Who do you look to? Do you know what I mean? Who, not in terms of a person, but in terms of a kind of who speaks for this, who speaks to or for this moment. And I'm really not looking for a leader here, but I am looking for the kind of structures that can sustain it through those moments where the media does lose interest, and through those moments that are far more boring. There's a lot of boring stuff that goes on in movement work, and there, America, because it has centuries old institutions, NAACP, Urban League, Black churches, and so on, they can kind of incubate this until the next kind of explosion. Whereas we don't have those long-standing institutions, and to me that is a bit of a worry. But the hope comes in the fact that I do hear of and see in different, smaller, less mediated or unmediated moments, people responding differently. People have been conscientized, radicalized by this moment, and then are taking it into different places, different structures, and raising questions. How sustainable that is, I don't know. And it's anecdotal anyway, so you know, it may just be my little bubble, but all bubbles are worthy and equal, and it's kind of to that extent, it's an observation worth sharing, even if I don't know quite how widespread it is.
Let's Gary, let's what one of your observations there about the US and how race relations there is perhaps different, also kind of the differences and the similarities to what we have here. Now, I remember, Gary, you wrote an article years ago, and you were talking about how you were in Mississippi, you were driving a car, and you stopped and you went to go ask an old white guy on the porch for directions. And he picked up a gun and said something like, "Boy, if you don't get off my porch, I'll shoot you." And then you went home and you told your wife and your mother-in-law. And the first thing they both said to you was, "Why the hell did you stop to ask an old white guy in Mississippi for directions for?" Mm. What is it that you think that is different about race relations from here, between here and the US? Because sometimes it feels like we do and don't understand, and we understand what things are like in the USA, and we have kind of more or less of an idea of what race actually means there.
Yeah. So I guess a few things. First of all, there are significantly more black people. 12% of the country, we're about 4% of the country, I think. Just kind of ethnically black of African, sub-Saharan descent. That makes quite a big difference. They have been there in large numbers for longer. They have a substantial moneyed middle class, which we don't. All of those things make a difference in terms of leverage. If 12% of people say they're not going to do something, that is different than 4% of people with less money and less roots. Then there's the fact that America is a more lethal country, generally. 70-odd people get shot dead every day. Now we're up to 9 kids a day get shot dead. So racism is more lethal. And that makes a difference in terms of how one understands it. And then America had all of its, nearly all of its racial strife at home. Even George Bush, after Katrina, says, "This, you know, we have a stain on our history," or whatever it is he said, you know, like segregation, blah, blah, blah. Whereas because most of our codified racism happened abroad, in the colonies, and because our civil rights movement mostly happened abroad, it's not that we didn't have one here, but it was our civil rights leaders are kind of Gandhi and Nkrumah and Nyeri and so on, then there is a degree of ignorance and willful amnesia that white people can have. So Gordon Brown and Tony Blair can both say, we should be proud of the empire. We should be proud of what it did, which no one in America is going to say. We should be proud of it. Well, actually, Donald Trump probably would, but generally speaking, people, you know, mainstream politicians, certainly not of the center left, is going to say we should be proud of segregation and proud of Jim Crow. So you have a less educated, less conscientized, more amnesiac white population, and then you have a black population that does know. Because they experienced it, and it's been passed down, and there is an awareness, which brings me to two final points. One is that Black British culture is a more internationalist and global culture. We are more recent. We are also generally from elsewhere. Generally, not necessarily us, but our parents, and so. We have a sensibility towards the Caribbean, towards Africa, and actually towards India and kind of other places, because in all sorts of ways that becomes part of our culture here. So there's a more internationalist perspective. And then because of Britain's political history, there is a kind of greater amount of class consciousness among Black Britons than you would generally find among African Americans. So, an African American, I would say, is much more race conscious, Black nationalism, Pan Africanism, that kind of thing, Black nationalism, really. Whereas there is more of a tradition that exists here too, and there is a Black socialist tradition in America, but it's much bigger here. Darkest House, C.L.R. James, LaRose. You know, there's a much greater tradition here, but I don't know. What do you think?
I did when I was much younger, so I didn't have a perception of maybe how prevalent sort of racial tensions were in America at the time. I think I was like 11 when I went over to Florida. I guess I have 2 points on like the race relations in the US and UK and the differences and similarities. So in terms of similarities, Europe, there are similar problems we have in Europe that we have in America. So like Black Europeans are more likely to die and live in poverty and deprivation. And we also see high levels of incarceration and unemployment among Black Europeans, Black Brits, similar to in America, which also has high levels of incarceration, certainly. We also look at coronavirus, for example, and the idea that, you know, Black people are 2 to 3 times more likely to contract and die from coronavirus than Americans. Black Americans are twice as likely to contract coronavirus than their white counterparts. So there are similarities in terms of the disparities Black people face in Europe and in America. But I guess the point you make about America being a more lethal country is a really important one, because I guess there's a feeling of moral superiority in Britain where it's like our racism is not as lethal as America's racism. And it's like, well, force their residents more lethal. The gun culture there means that everyone, literally nearly everyone, has a gun. And by extension, that means their racism is going to be a lot more lethal because, you know, there are more killings, and that's going to make the racism a lot more lethal. And I think it's a perverse state of affairs where you're kind of saying, well, their racism is more lethal than ours, because you're kind of saying, well, there's a certain level of racism that's acceptable. And the level of racism in the UK is more acceptable than the level of racism in America. And I think we need to just focus on the idea that all oppression, all racism is bad and should be dealt with and tackled with. And I guess in America as well, you mentioned the idea of Jim Crow and having that legacy in America, and the fact that we had these egregious forms of anti-black racism that happened elsewhere. So we had slavery obviously happened elsewhere. I guess there's this amnesia about British history, and it's something you always speak about, Gary, the idea that people say we won the World Cup, we won the war, but people never ever identify with the history and the legacy of colonialism and the empire. It's like, well, that wasn't us, you know, that was our ancestors. Like, you can't hold us accountable for the empire. And it's like, you know, I think Britain's history is intimately tied with white supremacy. And the sort of anti-black systems of oppression we have in this country kind of root back to the legacy of empire. And really, we need to contend with that history to kind of better understand the problems that exist in Britain today. And I think the idea of Britain's greatness is inherently tied with the British Empire, which was a white supremacist genocidal project. And we don't contend with this history. We literally don't. Like, I went through whole of my school time and university time without learning about the British Empire, or certainly the negative aspects of the British Empire. I learned about how Britain went around the world and grabbed resources and was a force for good when I was at school. I didn't learn about the horrific brutality of empire when I was at school. And I think that's a huge problem, because we sort of see it feed into the problems we have today. We sort of feed into how the Windrush generation are perceived and how they were viewed as not British citizens when they actually arrived to the UK as British citizens. And we sort of see the issue of Brexit and how, listen, Brexit, not everyone who voted for Brexit was a racist. I think that'd be an ignorant point to make, but certainly it was driven by this longing for empire and this desire for those days, the glory days of empire, because of this warped view we have of empire. And even the discussion around Winston Churchill, I find quite fascinating. So he's someone that's venerated and celebrated in Britain, and his legacy is linked to empire. He loved empire. But if you say a bad word about Winston Churchill, you know, you're going to get, on Twitter, for example, you're going to get abused by all and sundry. Everyone's going to call you out and say you're not British and you're insulting a British hero. So I guess we have this real historical amnesia, and we need to contend with that to address the issues that Britain contends with today.
Yeah, I mean, I would say two things. I think it's fine for people to say America's racism is more lethal, because that's true. It's when they ask, which they did, you know, in America for 12 years for The Guardian, and people would say, so are you coming back? I came back in 2015. They would say, are you coming back because of Black Lives Matter? And I'd be like, yeah. I thought I would escape American racism by coming to Hackney. Like, no, that's not how it works. Like, you don't get to escape racism kind of geographically. You can get yourself out of a tight spot, like, you know, you can escape from South Africa and apartheid and be a refugee from that, sure. But the notion that there are better and worse forms of racism is an obnoxious one, really, where you have to choose where you would rather be oppressed, but never get to choose where you would actually like to live as a free person. And then the other is just that kind of, because there is the amnesia among a section of white Britain, and it's very selective, because the very people who don't know what the empire did will still say, put in a great in Great Britain, or we were once a great country, or the sun never set, or so they have some sense of Britain's greatness, but not the brutality to acquire it. But, you know, to take Sivanandan's aphorism of, you know, well, we are here because you were there. Well, of course, if you didn't know that you were there, then you don't understand why we're here. And so you don't kind of, so that you are kind of, you kind of stand untethered from your history, which is a very, very kind of precarious place to be, actually, kind of without any understanding of, you know, it's like, look, no hands, no strings. You know, where did this country come from? How did we get all this stuff? How did this little place get to be one of the biggest economies in the world? How did that happen? And that kind of one of the paradoxes about, you know, the conversation around the Colson statue or other statues is that you have the conservatives, not the Conservative Party, but conservative people saying you want to do away with history. And so actually what we want to do is have a more full accounting of history. And what you want to do is say, why are you bringing up old stuff? That we want to talk about all of the shit that happened. We want to talk about good and bad. We want to talk about the cotton workers in Manchester, Lily White, who would rather starve than handle Confederate cotton during the Civil War. And we want to talk about, you know, Churchill and, you know, racism and empire, and let's talk about all of it. And so there is this nonsense that we are the ones trying to shut down the historical conversation, when actually, first of all, statues aren't history. They're celebrations of individuals in history. And then you've got to ask yourself, why do you want to celebrate that dude? And secondly, we're not, we are the ones who are trying to fill the history in, and they are the ones who are running away from it, which is why Black History Month in both Britain and America, in my experience, is generally told in the passive tense. It's one of my passive voice. It's one of my kind of bugbears about it. Rosa Parks was kicked off the bus. Well, she didn't kick herself off the bus. Somebody kicked her off the bus. But you never learn about Mr. Blake. You never learn about the man who kicked her off the bus. Black people were enslaved. Places were colonized. It's always, and so if there is Black history, there must also be white history. That stands to reason. You can't have one without the other. And one of the problems, I think, with the way that Black history is taught is that it's, first of all, it's taught in a kind of like we were once kings, which I find obnoxious. I just think, well, if we were kings, we were serfs as well. When do we get to talk about them? Only one person gets to be king. Lots of people get to be serfs. But also, the problem with Black History Month is that there are too few white people in it, paradoxically. And I don't just mean baddies, you know, John Brown. I don't feel it's my job to say, you know, some of my best historical figures are white. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of, you know, that's not necessary. But we tell it in a way that is kind of, or it is told in a way that is often untethered from its other racial protagonists.
Yeah. And Gary, I actually have a question and a point on the statues. I think it's a really important point. Like, statues are symbols of veneration, so they're about the history what we should project. And the idea that we have statues of slave traders in public spaces is obviously it's wrong. That's not the history we as a nation should project. We shouldn't have that, you know, those symbols of veneration in city centres. And I was obviously really glad that Colson statue was pulled down, and that was for me a really powerful moment in the summer's protests. I have a question about like the Conservatives and Joe Biden. So the Conservatives obviously in power in Britain, they won the 2019 general election, and what we have seen is they've launched this commission into racial inequality. I'm not entirely sure why there's a commission being launched racial inequality when the governments have loads of recommendations from other reports on racial inequality, and they chose not to implement any of the recommendations from these reports. So they're sitting on loads of recommendations from reviews in the past, and they're not implementing these recommendations. And I'm skeptical about this, the new report they've commissioned, because it's going to be headed up by Tony Sewell, who's someone who's expressed skepticism about institutional racism. And that's a problem we need to address in the UK. So if the person heading up the commission on racial inequality is skeptical about racial systemic racism, institutional racism, you know, that's a really bad place to start. So I guess the first question is, how do you think the Conservatives are going to deal with racial injustice moving forward? And also looking at Joe Biden. So as we mentioned earlier on, he's someone that was, he received the vote of confidence in Black voters during the primaries, particularly older Black voters during the primaries, Democratic primaries. And also what we saw at the election is Black voters turn out in huge numbers to vote for Joe Biden. I'm skeptical because he has a checkered history on race and racism. So he offered the 1994 crime bill. He worked with segregationists to oppose desegregationist policies in the 1970s. He's also made some odd comments, like I think he was on a radio show during the election run-in, and his line was, if you don't vote for the Democrats, you ain't black. And it's to using, I think left-wing parties do this a lot, using a vote for them as a barometer of blackness. And it's really irritating. But I do think that black people have endorsed Biden in huge numbers. And I am infused by his message of unity and his message of, I'm going to fight for the black community in America. So I guess, like, what do you think the conservatives and Joe Biden are going to do in terms of addressing racial injustice in both countries?
Well, I mean, I think that starting in Britain, I think the Conservative Party, I remember interviewing Angela Davis and her talking about the model of diversity as being the difference that brings no difference and the change that brings no change. So where you have a kind of institution in the world that looks different and acts the same or even worse. And that's what I think we're seeing in the Tory party. So it's the most diverse cabinet that there's ever been. And it's also the most reactionary in terms of race and pretty much everything else that we've seen for a while. And I think their contempt was made clear through the people that they have appointed to all sorts of things to do with race and racism. So I'm not expecting anything from this review. They haven't asked anybody that I can think of that I really kind of respect who's done kind of serious kind of work on this. And I feel like it's a thing that they felt they had to do, and it will come up with a whole lot of horseshit, and then we'll have to kind of, you know, we'll have to deal with that horseshit. But I'm not expecting anything from it. I don't expect anything from them. I'd be delighted to be surprised. But it's kind of, it's apple from a poison tree, if you see what I mean. If you start by appointing a group of people who a significant number of black people have no confidence in, then where's that going to end up? So there's that. When it comes to Biden and black voters in America, there's a few things. First of all, I don't even think his history is that checkered. I think his history is just pretty straight up racist, actually. I mean, he opposed busing in the 70s. He stiffed Anita Hill. He the crime bill. He talked about Obama as being kind of the first black politician who's articulate and clean. And, you know, he's I think he's got really quite bad racial politics. I think that to some extent, African-Americans' kind of electoral choices are a little bit of a mystery to me, because I also love Bill Clinton, which was one of the worst periods in terms of black American history, in terms of the massive increase in incarceration rates, the welfare bill. I mean, Clinton did preside over a huge period of economic growth, which had nothing to do with him, but I think there was an awful lot about his performance as a Southerner. He knew the words to the Black National Anthem. He was a kind of, that there was something in his affect that they liked, and politics is as much about a performance as anything else. It was interesting how kind of fragile that seemed to be when he started kind of talking smack about Obama in 2008. And African-Americans just were like, whoa. You know, there's only so far you can go with that. So, with Biden, I actually don't even like his appeals for unity particularly, because it's like, unity on what basis? I mean, after the Civil War, they had the Reconstruction era, and then they said, we've got to unite the country, and they united the country at African-Americans' expense. They said, okay, we'll just go back to the old way, and that way the Southern good old boys won't be so upset. And so I think that African-Americans turned out for him, older African-Americans, during the nomination process in South Carolina, because they thought that Bernie Sanders couldn't win. And they really, really wanted to get rid of Trump. So if you look at African-Americans and where they stand on policy issues, they're much closer to Joe Biden in terms of what their demands were, what they favored. But they didn't think he could win, and they weren't going to take that chance. And it was a chance. I think it was, I always said, I think Sanders was a chance worth taking, and I think Biden was a chance not worth taking, frankly. But kind of that was the chance that they took. I would have voted for Biden if I had a vote. And African-American voters are quite conservative like that. So if you look at the polling with Obama, they really didn't start coming out for Obama in any big numbers, polling-wise, until he'd won Iowa. And when he won Iowa, African-Americans, I believe, and I was there at the time, thought, fine, if white people are going to vote for him, then fine. But what we're not going to do is just kind of go for the dude because he's black, because we need to win. Mm-hmm. And then I don't think they turned out in large numbers for Biden in the election. I think they turned out in large numbers against Trump. That I think Trump drove them to the polls. And at that point, Biden was the only viable alternative. And, I could be wrong about both of those things. And I guess we'll see. But
I would say on the first bit there, Gary, I think you're right, because I know the Obama campaign's entire strategy was around winning Iowa, because they said, as soon as we win Iowa, we show that we're a serious contender for the nomination. And the reason why they were the only serious contender against the Clinton machine was because Hillary Clinton was seen to have a lock on the black population, unless the only other person who could kind of ever come and take that was, of course, Barack Obama, right? The guy who, but to them it was a bit like, I suppose you described the Sanders choice there before Iowa, perhaps it was like a bit pie in the sky. It was like, yes, he's articulate. Yes, he's, you know, he can speak well, but actually a bit young, a bit green. And then when he won Iowa, he became a serious contender. Everyone, hold on a second, actually, this guy's some serious quality. And clearly he did. This is a good place to kind of wrap things up. Do you guys have any final thoughts before we kind of sign off?
Mike, are you hopeful?
I'm skeptical. Certainly, I shared your concerns. We did a podcast 2 days ago reflecting on the election. I was skeptical because Biden's record on racial justice is quite appalling, to be honest with you. It really is. I think Checker is probably an understatement, really. He worked on segregation list, the crime bill. You mentioned a few other things. His record is quite poor. I'm not hopeful in the UK, certainly. I think the government's response to Black Lives Matter has lacked urgency, and you know, they focused on statues and created this confected culture war, where it's like, you know, Black Lives Matter is trying to attack our history. And it's like, well, no, we're just trying to, we want you to present a more nuanced version of British history and address systemic racism and anti-Black racism in Britain. That's what we want. We don't want you to present this false version of British history. So that's the first thing, I think. And yeah, I am hopeful, because I was really infused by the protests over the summer. Like, they were the widest and largest protest, anti-racist protests in British history. And for me, it was remarkable. I was, during a pandemic, to see people turn out in large numbers to oppose anti-Black racism and to raise awareness about anti-Black racism was really, really powerful. And I am heartened by that, but I'm heartened by the policy response to this. I'm skeptical about the policy response to this. I'm skeptical about what the Conservative government are going to do following this report in December, whenever it's going to be released. I'm skeptical about the findings of this report, let alone what they're going to do with the report. I'm skeptical about Biden and what his presidency represents for Black America. Yes, Black people voted in large numbers for Biden, but there is, as you mentioned, Gary, it could be because they wanted to get rid of Donald Trump, and that could be the real driving force, and not because they're desperate for a Biden presidency. So I guess the jury's still out on both governments, right? So the Biden government, obviously, they would come into power in January, and we're going to see what the Conservative government continue to do on race and racism. I guess the final thing would be a point on racial gatekeeping and Johnson's rhetoric. So Johnson's rhetoric inspires no hope at all. I mean, he's compared Muslim women in burqas to letterboxes, and this government inspired no confidence either. So I think what this government do, you mentioned earlier, Gary, was the idea that it's the most ethnically diverse governments in history. So we have the four great officers of state. We have Rishi Sunak as the Chancellor, and we have Priti Patel as the Home Secretary. But what I think the Conservatives have done in recent months following the Black Lives Matter protest is weaponize the ethnicity of these politicians to continue to pursue a politics that is racially oppressive. So essentially, they use Priti Patel's ethnicity, they use Kemi Badenoch's ethnicity, and it's like they can advocate for these racially repressive views and these racially repressive policies, but they can't be criticized because they are also minorities. So how on earth, why would they pursue racially repressive policies? Now, for me, I read a really powerful piece on this about racial gatekeeping and the idea that this allows the Conservatives to shield themselves from criticism for their racist policies because they essentially put a black or brown face to present this policy or to advocate for this policy, and they try to diminish the what people would view as a racially oppressive policy, try to diminish that in the public's view. And that's something Conservatives are going to do moving forward. I think Priti Patel as the Home Secretary is dangerous for the lives of black Brits, Asian Brits, ethnic minorities in Britain. So am I hopeful? I'm hopeful by what I've seen over the summer with young people taking to the streets, but I'm not hopeful that governments, certainly in the UK and the US, are going to take the necessary action required.
Yeah, I mean, the last point you made is the important one, because there is a sloppiness among liberals in particular about representation. And I remember it when Obama was standing and people would say to me, this is going to be, we're going to have a black president. It's going to be fantastic. And I would say, would you say that if it was Condoleezza Rice? And they say, well, no. And I'd say, right, well, then you're going to want to kind of, you're going to want to bed down on that one then and kind of come up with something else, because it's not just because he's black, is it? And so there is this, if all you have is a call for greater ethnic representation without any sense of what it's for, then you can easily end up with in this situation where people can say, but look, we're diverse, and you end up with photo opportunities rather than equal opportunities. And it's a very, very kind of dangerous situation. I feel like, actually, the jury's not out on this government. The jury came in even before it was elected, and they have an awful, Boris Johnson has an awful racial history, which he's never fully accounted for, never been asked to account for. And they are extremely cynical about racial equality, and they are quite canny about racial representation. And so I'm not expecting anything from them. I do think the jury's out on Biden, because he ain't started yet. And you have an emboldened African-American community from the summer. One of the stars of this election is Stacey Abrams, who effectively, once the recount is in, I think we'll find, delivered Georgia to the Democrats. Something that Georgia hasn't gone Democrat since 92. And Clinton couldn't win it back, even in 96. So I think, very little was expected of LBJ when he took over from Kennedy in 63. And he sat around a table on the night of Kennedy's funeral, and people are saying to him, don't go for civil rights, because there aren't the votes. The Democrats at the time were a mixture of Southern racists and Northern liberals. People saying, don't do it. And he says, well, what the hell's the presidency for? And in those 4 years, as a one and a bit term president of Lyndon Johnson, you get the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, Medicaid, Medicare, all of that. And I don't know that anybody saw that coming from Vice President Johnson of Texas. So the past shapes us, but it doesn't kind of define us. And so I think there's precious little in this history. What we need is something transformative right now. This notion of like heal and unite, it's like around what, right? Because in moments of previous racial tension, whether it's Lincoln or LBJ, it has been the people who have done the bold things and the transformative things that have made the difference. And they were pushed to do that by external circumstances. And in this case, there is an emboldened, enlivened, energized anti-racist movement. So I have more hope there. Anything that happens in Britain, I think, is going to happen outside of mainstream politics. I don't have a whole lot of hope in the Labour Party at the moment either, but I think that by and large, the kind of left energy has gone out of the Labour Party, which I'm not sure that I like the way that that happened, but now that it's happened, I think that gives us the opportunity to actually do more things and concentrate on just keeping one person in the leadership as he's being kind of taken fire from his own side. So, I mean, I was born hopeful. I don't see much right now in Britain to be kind of extraordinarily hopeful about, but I'm also not expecting much to be disappointed about, because I think I've already banked my disappointment, particularly with this government.
If you guys, just before we end up, close up, one tiny nugget of hope is that so last time the PhD also teach with the Brilliant Club, where they send you into like less advantaged schools to help them, you know, get into universities, basically. And when I was teaching these kids and they have this exercise, they have to pretend to be prime ministers and cabinet ministers. The one proposal they wanted to put forward was to learn more Black history. And these kids are 11. And I was like, geez. And I was like, really? They're like, yeah. And their issue was that they only learned about slavery. And they were like, there's so much else out there. And I was really taken aback. That was not the answer I was expecting. I mean, I was putting forward, like, as the example exercise, things like, you know, children should stay at school for an extra hour a day. I just was not expecting this this to come out, and it was really enthusing and like a small hopeful moment. Well, Gary, it's been great having you on. Before we end up, what is your jam of the week for our listeners this week?
Well, my jam is Young, Gifted and Black. This was the song that my mum used to sing and put on when I was little, and my brothers were little, and she'd say, and if it was on the radio, they're playing our song, and obviously Young, you know, the name and all of that, but it was, I said I was born hopeful, and to me, she's a single mom, three kids, my dad left when I was one, and there was nothing around us that would suggest, that was saying that to us. And she would put my feet on her feet and dance around the living room and to that song to kind of sing us up. And that one of the things I think is crucial on the left, which is where I stand, is imagining a world that doesn't exist. Because otherwise what you do, the world that we live in is insufficient for all sorts of reasons. And this to me was a kind of small, personal, vivid example of someone doing exactly that.
That's a wonderful song. Thanks a lot, guys. It's a great story as well. Thanks for having us on. And thanks a lot.
Thank you, guys.
See you. We'll see you again next week. See you.
Yeah, thanks, Ivan. Thanks, Mike. See you again.